Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding health, food, and environmental journalist, writer, and author. I report in a variety of venues, including EcoWatch, Huffington Post, Alternet, and many more. And every week on Connect the Dots, this radio program on Progressive Radio, I connect the dots between personal health and our total health environment, including the health of our food, water, air, and earth, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and the health of planet Earth. And every week on Connect the Dots, I bring different experts, authors, scientists, advocates, to you in order to better different aspects of health. And it's kind of a variety show around that single theme. Last week we had a wonderful program on the evolution of medicine. This week we're shifting gears and talking about global trade agreements and what they portend. Also noting that this week is the week of the big climate march in New York. I will be participating. I know many of you will be too. I know many wonderful people coming in from all around the country and a whole range of different groups joining together to show our solidarity for protecting the climate and you know, kind of calling a halt and transitioning away from the kinds of fossil fuel use and other activities that are making, you know, risk to make our planet uninhabitable, not only for our own species, but for many others. So today's show, we're taking a kind of slightly different slant on that. And it doesn't only and singularly affect the climate, although that's a kind of global overarching issue. We're going to be talking about trade agreements, and they do have major impacts on activities to protect the climate, as we'll discuss throughout the show, as well as a host of other things. For those of you who listen to the show regularly, you may recall that last May, June, I had an entire month devoted to trade agreements and net neutrality and a bunch of other things that are all interrelated, because we can make wonderful choices for our personal health, and I've been an advocate of that for 25 years. But we also need our laws, our regulations, our global agreements, all of our public policies to work for our health and environmental goals rather than against them. So today I'm bringing back a guest that we had on last May, and you can also listen to that past show after you've heard this one. His name is Stan Sorcher. He's a labor representative at the Society for Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace. Now, that sounds like an unusual position to be holding as a guest on my show, but it isn't, because this is a union. It represents over 24,000 scientists, engineers, pilots, technical and professional employees in the aerospace industry. And, you know, although unions have been knocked and taken down and discredited in our day, actually they represent a time-honored organizing, you know, community of common interest in the workplace that represents both the interests of professionals in the workplace and workers in the workplace, but also they can be consonant with our own interests too, even if we don't happen to be in that particular field. Stan is very knowledgeable on the subject of trade agreements, our subject for today's show. He serves on the executive board of the Washington Fair Trade Coalition and has been very active in analyzing the trade agreements and languaging for the general public, the problems with them, as well as representing, you know, the public voice in a number of different vectors around these issues. So we'll be talking about trade agreements today and kind of interweaving it in as well with their role in our ability to protect our environmental concerns on today's show. I'm calling the show today Trade Deals with Boomerangs. So welcome back again to Connect the Dots, Stan Sorcher.
Thanks for having me. It's great talking with you.
Yeah. So, you know, can you give our listeners an update, you know, back in May, part of the real focus of activist efforts to sort of call a halt or pause some of these secret agreements that the government was trying to kind of rush forward in something called fast track. That was kind of the urgent thing at that time, was stopping fast track so that we wouldn't pass a lot of global treaties that have overarching authority over our society without even knowing what was in them. Can you update our listeners as to where things now stand with fast track and with the trade agreements under discussion?
Sure. So the trade agreements we're talking about are the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has been under negotiation for several years and represents about 12 countries around the Pacific and arguably 40% of global economic activity. And there's another very large trade agreement between the United States and Europe called TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, of roughly comparable in size to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Both of these will be very complicated agreements with thousands of pages and lots of provisions. When they go to Congress, the approval process in the Constitution is that if they were a treaty, the Congress would debate the provisions of the treaty, and they'd be allowed to amend or change the provisions and finally approve it. The fast track, or trade promotion authority, as it's called, is a procedural arrangement that's been used since the Nixon administration. It says whatever the deal is that was negotiated, you have to vote up or down. There's no opportunity for amendment, very limited debate, and in particular, you can't filibuster or use any of the other rules of regular order in the Senate, which we know can be very powerful. So fast track is really a procedural arrangement that makes it a lot easier to ratify the agreement. A bill was introduced in the House and an identical bill in the Senate for this fast-track provision. Neither of them are going anywhere and are arguably dead in the sense that anything in Congress is ever dead. And Senator Wyden from Oregon is now the chair of the Finance Committee in the Senate, and he is he had the most leverage or authority over how this goes forward. He wants to write a new fast-track bill, which he calls Smart Track. And we haven't seen it yet, and I'm not aware that anybody has seen language, certainly not in public, about what the difference would be between the fast-track and the Smart Track. During the campaign season and the election season, there's been no interest at all in moving forward on the old fast track or the new smart track, partly because of the dynamics of the campaign. Most people who are aware of the trade agreements associate them with a global race to the bottom, and it's very difficult for an elected official to campaign on something that will be presumed to be, you know, bad for the electorate. So that's a political calculation. One thing we've heard is that after the election, there will be what's called the lame duck session, where the current elected officials will go back after the election to clean up whatever they can or whatever needs to be cleaned up before the end of the year and before the next Congress, the next session of Congress with the new elected official comes to Washington, D.C. So there is the potential that after the election and in the lame duck session, something would happen. The political dynamics of lame duck sessions are always very complicated, beyond my ability to understand. But there is a lot of talk that something could happen regarding trade promotion authority in lame duck. So, again, what the difference between good and bad here is the Trade Promotion Authority is Congress's opportunity to say, we as the elected officials accountable to our constituents want to see these provisions in the final trade agreement. If you have these provisions, whatever they are for the environment or human rights or labor rights or public health, if the favorable provisions are there, then fast track will apply and you can use these expedited procedures. But if they're not present in the agreement, then fast track would be suspended. That would be an interesting thing. Typically, Congress doesn't do that. They say, well, we would certainly like to see these provisions. This is our direction to the negotiators. We would like to see these favorable provisions about public interest. But if you don't, you still have fast track. So that's what the current bills look like. They give the direction of Congress, but there's no enforceable provisions that the direction be followed. It's possible that that's what Senator Wyden has in mind when he talks about Smart Track. The cynical view is that he will just tweak the weak provisions of the current Camp Baucus, with Dave Camp in the House and Max Baucus in the Senate, the two authors. He might just tweak the weak provisions of the Camp Baucus bill and call that smart, which it may be in some sense. But anyway, that's kind of the prospect over the next couple of months. When we get to the new Congress, I guess we just have to see what happens there about what the balance of power and the interest of the new Congress have.
So, in other words, we're kind of in a neutral, waiting to see position in terms of activist direction right now, as we are talking about this on the show today. Let's backtrack a bit and talk a bit more about these treaties and your concerns about them for listeners new to this topic.
So one thing that we're seeing more of, there's more and more public discussion of this, which is good. And one of the perspectives that I think is useful is to not think of them as trade agreements. If you and I were negotiating a trade agreement, it would be really boring. But if you and I were writing a moral, social, and political document that would determine how life is organized in 2050, now that's interesting. So these aren't really trade agreements. And, you know, your other guests, Margaret Flowers and Professor Levine, talked about a lot of examples of this that really look like a political process. These are the rules for a political process. And I don't think of them, the trade agreement, so much as dealing with trade as dealing with a global governance. I mean, how would we, as sovereign nations, manage globalization? And so the trade agreements are going to express our moral values, whatever those are, or whatever the values of the people writing the agreements are. And then this will have an effect on our social behavior. So you talk about, you know, public health or access to medicine or education or human rights or labor rights, and certainly all the environmental issues that we have to deal with going forward as a planet. These are all very, very important social issues. And then we'll have policy, some kind of political behavior that we're going to use to express our values and deal with our social issues. The trade agreements will be the context at the global level for doing that. So they're, I mean, it's not a very catchy bumper sticker to say they're global governance documents, but they really are much more than trade agreements. They're really going to be, and an ambassador from Portugal was speaking locally here, and he used that expression that these trade agreements will determine how life is organized in 2050. And his point was global corporations, multinational corporations are going to be very pleased with it. It's going to be to their advantage the way life is organized, you know, for a generation or two going forward.
Could you give an example of that? Like, how would that be to their favor, you know? And Yeah.
Right. So we talked about this in May, and then David Levine talked about fracking in Quebec, which is kind of a particularly good example of this. But a Canadian company has mining rights to frack under the St. Lawrence Seaway, the principal waterway of Canada. There's mm-hmm. starting to be evidence that maybe this isn't such a great idea, and the province of Quebec said, let's have a moratorium on fracking under the St. Lawrence Seaway while we study the effects for the quality of the water and health consequences and other kind of technical issues. As mm-hmm. a Canadian company, the oil company had a political process that they went through, and in Canada, there's a strong interest in public good, and the Canadian company had to accept in the Canadian political process this moratorium, had to accept the moratorium, because that's the way the political process works. Mm-hmm. That would be the end of it if they were a Canadian company. They did create a subsidiary, had a subsidiary in the United States. The subsidiary had authority under NAFTA to go to this dispute settlement process under NAFTA, which is a greater right than the Canadian company had as a Canadian company. So mm-hmm. under the trade agreement, there's this dispute settlement process that says we can use different standards, different moral values, different legal standards to decide if this fracking moratorium was a reasonable policy. And mm-hmm. that gives them a second bite at the apple, as the lawyers say, but in a much more favorable venue. The mm-hmm. Dispute settlement process is designed around the interests of businesses. And the value of public interest in the is very low in the dispute settlement process. And so the composition of the arbitration panel is favorable to the businesses. The mm-hmm. process itself is closed, and there's no option for public engagement. There's no accountability.
Unbelievable.
It's you know, I was talking to somebody about this, and she gave the example of the East India Company that ran India. And it was a failure of my high school education. I didn't really understand much about the East India Company. But England, by Act of Parliament, gave authority to the East India Company to administer empire in India. Well, okay, I think I knew that. Mm-hmm. It has a very creepy feel, right? This is the administration of empire. Mm-hmm. And you know that the colonialists, the British colonialists, are going to do very well. And the indigenous people of India, you know, the people of India are not going to do so well under this corporate administration of power. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they did is set up separate courts for the colonialists. Why would the colonialists have to deal with Indian, you know, local courts?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess that's obvious, right? Mm. But part of the psychology of this is that the dispute settlement activity is always expressed in these very arcane, highly technical, very detailed terms. And mm-hmm. it kind of, you have to step back a little bit and say, well what is really going on here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when you step back and say what is really going on, you see that global corporations have decided that they may have lost this battle historically about the balance of interest between public and private interests. They may have lost that battle in America. They may have lost that battle in Australia. They may have lost that battle in Canada and England. But they get a second try here. If they were going to redesign the political process in terms of how much regulation they have to put up with, here are these trade agreements. Let's go. Let very smart corporate lawyers think about how they would put together a process that's going to give them the outcome that they want. And so, again, that's kind of what, you know, the U.S. Constitution did this for us. And we can talk about who is at the table to write that. But we actually had a pretty good system that's lasted for centuries. that does a fairly good job of balancing public interest and private interest, partly, I would think, because the word corporation never appears in the U.S. Constitution, not even once. Mm-hmm. And the Constitution and the Bill of Rights are full of protections for people, for, you know, most people. But if you count the other later amendments to the Bill of Rights, it's much more about people. Mm-hmm. So, in particular, the Fourth Amendment talks about search and seizure, and that the government can't take property without due process. Mm-hmm. And so, in that legal tradition, there's this expectation that the public interest is legitimate, and our historic interpretation of that is you can regulate the public good, and we all accept that as one of our values as a society and as a country. Of course, you can regulate the public good. Mm-hmm. The purpose of regulation is to protect the public good. And so we recognize a balance between public and private. So a regulatory taking, as they say, is where the government takes everything. Right? So I need your property. I'm going to build a freeway to your property. I'm taking it. And then we have to compensate them, right? That's again, one of our moral values. If we say you have a wetland on your property, you can keep the property, but you cannot build certain structures on the wetland. That's part of that gray area, right? I didn't take your property, but I've limited your use of it. And in the public good, you know, we accept that. Under the trade agreement, they said, well, why would we even accept that balance of power? If you take anything from me, the way the trade agreements are written, a global corporation can say, if you take anything from me, I want compensation. There's no gray area. And in particular, if you take my future profits from fracking under the St. Lawrence Seaway, I want to be paid for that. If you have dolphin-safe tuna and you limit my access, I'm a Mexican tuna fishery, and you limit my access to the American domestic market because I don't use dolphin-safe methods, that's a taking, and I want to be compensated for that. If I'm an Indonesian clove farmer, and I'm selling my clove for clove cigarette, and the clove cigarettes are targeted at children, and the American public health interest is to prevent children from smoking, the Indian agricultural business can say, wait a minute, that's a taking. I want to be compensated for my future sales and profits of clove cigarettes, which I, you know, will be denied. So the whole emphasis here in the moral values and the sense of proportion and where's the difference between public good and private good written into these trade agreements to the advantage of trading companies, giving them greater rights than they would have had as a domestic company in any of the countries involved.
Well, it's not only greater rights as a domestic company, but it's presuming that business interests prevail over everything whatsoever, and that the, you know, resources of the seaway, the cloves for the cigarettes, whatever it is, are, you know, presumed to be theirs, so that other people have to compensate them for any other value entering in. This is like, to, you know, it's like Citizen United on steroids.
Well, yeah, it is. So part of it, you know, there's a philosophy that that goes with this, and it's the, you know, free trade, free market philosophy. And that resonates with a lot of people, and you know, especially since, you know, 1980 or, you know, the late 70s. Free markets will solve all our problems, right? Government interference is bad. We've all heard this in our political discourse. And there's a very powerful psychology that goes with that. But, I mean, when you break it down, it's really about political power and economic power. And so the philosophy, free trade, oh, that must be good. Free markets, oh, that must be good. I don't know. And in the end, if you just look at what happened, what works, what are what are the consequences, it's much easier to understand as a political power expressed through these social and moral values of free trade and minimum possible regulation. So, we've heard this, about trickle-down economics. It has sort of a seductive appeal. And then, what happened to me, I didn't do very well in that. And somebody else did very well, and I did badly. And there's this sort of a moral sense of, how come I'm the victim here, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, if it can get very confusing, but if you think about it in terms of political power and the ability to extract gains from other stakeholders, it's just a pure power play. It's all very coherent from that point of view.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have a few marketing catchphrases like trickle down, which hasn't really worked if we look at what's actually happened to the economic structure of our society and the middle class. You can use the phrase trickle down, but what is the reality that all of the economic statistics show?
Right. So, I'm a scientist, right? And I would normally take that rational approach. And that's the Western, tradition, right? But so I go back to NAFTA and say, what were the four promises? There were four presidents who advocated for NAFTA. Gerald Ford and the George Bush, the first George Bush, and Clinton, and Jimmy Carter, and they all met for a big ceremony, right? And they gave these great speeches, and they made four promises that we would balance trade with Mexico, we would create millions of new jobs, we would solve the immigration problem with Mexico because Mexico would prosper and we would prosper, and we would have access to markets. Okay, those are four great promises. And then, as you said, we had 20 years of lived experience. What is our lived experience? Well, the trade deficit with Mexico became enormous. The immigration problem is legendary, and again, that's another connection between trade policy and public policy. Immigration is tied into that very directly. Did we create millions of new jobs? I'm not sure that's true at all. Right? And you're going through this list and you say, I have my lived experience. There can be no doubt of this. And the one that I get stuck on is access to market. And Ross Perot, those of us who are old enough to remember that, political debate, Ross Perot knew exactly what was going to happen regarding access to markets. When anybody, an advocate for this trade agreement, says you will have access to markets, we all think that we're going to get access to 1.5 billion consumers in China to buy the things that we make. But Ross Perot is an industrialist, and he knew exactly what would happen NAFTA, that he would be compelled by economic forces and his competitors to move his production to a low-wage, low-regulation country. And mm-hmm. as a patriot, that drove him nuts. And mm-hmm. his only recourse was to run for president against NAFTA so that he wouldn't be put in that impossible position as an industrialist. So he understood access to markets mean access to producers offshore who could produce goods and services to sell back to America. Right? Access to producers is what he heard. We heard access to consumers. Well, mm-hmm. we heard wrong. He was mm-hmm. right. That's exactly what happened. So the four promises, solve our immigration, create millions of new jobs, balance trade, and access to markets. If you're taking this as a rational question, the answer is this didn't work. There's no doubt about it. But I'm not sure answering our question is the driving factor here. Somebody did very, very well under these trade agreements. Not too many people, but people who have a lot of power and influence and who are doing very, 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 very well. So this trade agreement is working for the people who wrote it, because they knew exactly what they were doing, and for their interest. And and you know, this is sort of an example of what's going on politically, generally. That you know, in your introduction, you're talking about unions.
You know, I'm just going to let's hold that thought, because we're at the half hour where we break for station identification. So let's talk about unions, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on them in the second half hour of the show. Oh, is that okay? Yeah,
you bet.
I think it'll be great. So stay with us, listeners. We're coming back after the station ID for more conversation with Stan Sorcher about the globalization of the business dominant values, you know, that we've already had an ample taste of in terms of their interference in our political system and economy and values. So stay with us for the second half of Connect the Dots. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Thanks for coming back with us, listeners, and if you're just tuning in to the conversation I'm having today about the boomerangs in trade agreements with Stan Sorcher, labor representative at the Society for Professional Engineering Employees in aerospace. If you're just tuning in, please check out the archives later this afternoon for the second part of the show, or rather for the first part of the show, for the full show. And if you're enjoying the show, please like us on iTunes and pass it along to friends who may be interested. During the first half of the show, Stan was enlightening us about global trade agreements as really, you know, not just some kind of big regulatory thing happening out there, and I know many listeners of this show won't be regarding it that way anyhow, but really as ways of shifting global structure and value. So, you know, it's an opportunity that, you know, corporations are taking to shift values and policies and agreements to favor their business development toward their own profits, and once again further away from sharing public good, public infrastructures, public rights, voice, and protections. And so that's kind of a summary of what Stan was telling us in the first half of the show. So if you did miss that, please do go back to the archives later and give a listen. He does a really brilliant analysis of that. Of course, a lot of the public is engaged. Public outcry was able to stop Fast Track, which was pushing some key agreements through without anyone even knowing exactly what they were. So the public awareness campaign worked. The public outcry stopped it. But Stan also updated us that we're kind of in a pause and wait position here currently, as there may be further initiatives coming down the track to try to move this forward, principally, perhaps, during the upcoming lame duck Congress. This is when, you know, the vote has been taken on Election Day. We know who's leaving and who's coming back to Congress. And so those who are, it's a kind of a time when there are less repercussions and more push to pass unpopular legislation. So Stan has also counseled us that we should be on the lookout for activity and the need for action at that moment in time, if not sooner. There are several organizations that I'll mention a little bit later on in this half hour where you can kind of keep tabs. Meanwhile, back to our conversation, Stan was about to talk about unions, since he is a union representative, and their role in the debate over how much can and should the public good prevail over corporate interests. So welcome back again, Stan, to the second half hour, and looking forward to hearing your perspective on unions and the role they play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. In your introduction to the show, you mentioned that I work for a union, and you used the word voice several times, and that's sort of a code word in labor, in the labor movement, that the unions really are voice at work. And so for most workers, the voice they want at work is about work. It's about wages, benefits, and working conditions. And, you know, we're talking about the psychology of the trade agreements is really about driven by political power and interest. And workers have interests at work, and bargaining power, market power is part of how all those problems are solved, either in the workplace or at the larger level. Now, my interest in trade came from work. I work in the aerospace industry. We're 100% in favor of trade. We make products the rest of the world wants to buy. Let's talk about the way we will conduct trade. And as you know, we're talking about 20 years of lived experience with these trade agreements. Mm-hmm. My lived experience is that I'm watching one industry after another deindustrialized and all that work moved offshore. The aerospace industry makes complex, heavily engineered products, and we're late in this deindustrialization, but it's certainly very obvious to us in the workplace that our work is subject to being moved offshore, and mm-hmm. that's my economic well-being and the economic security of my family and my children. So it's immediately important to me, what's my voice in this issue? So from mm-hmm. the worker's point of view, I have institution of civil society, my union. If I'm an environmentalist, I have 350.org and the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society and Friends of Earth. I have institutions of civil society as an environmentalist that express my interest. If my interest is public health or internet freedom or financial regulation, the extent to which there are institutions that represent the interests of civil society will have a healthy political dynamic. So that's kind of, you know, my little soda straw that I look through comes from my workplace interest and my institution of civil society that gives me voice and engages in the political process is labor. In our history as a country, we've had periods where we've had more vigorous participation in the political process or less vigorous participation in the political process. That's a fascinating, you know, history to look at. But it all, in that case, all comes down to political power and, mm-hmm. and whose interests are being represented. There was a great book on trade, which I wish I had written, by Clyde Prestowitz, who is a trade specialist in, I think, the Reagan administration. And near the end of his book, he said of all the institutions of civil society, the one that he thought that came to his mind was being most most aligned with the public good was labor, because workers live in the community. Of course, environmentalists and public health advocates and other people also live in the community. But really, you need all of these institutions to be active vigorously to have an effective, political economy and an effective political system. So that's kind of the positive view of this. And then, the idealized positive view of this. And then you have the reality, you know, how do these interests balance out? So the trade agreements are really a test case for this. How are these interests engaged in writing the trade agreements? The trade agreements ultimately are going to affect everything, every aspect of public life. How they're written and the interests that go into them and the political dynamic that goes into that is going to be very, very important. We do have our tradition of political engagement in America, and they have a tradition in Canada, and they have a tradition in England. These trade agreements have a completely different political dynamic. The interests of civil society are not represented in the negotiation. There's no political system, really, other than what's in the trade agreements to enforce them. There's no accountability the way we think of a normal political system. The U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman was in town, and we had a chance, a large group of us had a chance to talk with him. And one of the things we said was, when Europe integrated their economies, right, however, I can never count the number of countries because they're different versions of this, but they have their European Union of Economic Integration. They have the European Committee that does something in the European Parliament. So they put together political systems in addition to their economic integration, because in their moral tradition, in their social tradition, their political tradition, this was important. They recognized the need for a political system in parallel with their economic system. When we put together the NAFTA with the three countries, we had the economic integration, but no political integration. TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and there's a third one coming out, trade in investment and services agreement, TISA, T-I-S-A. These will not have any parallel political structure remotely as powerful or important as the economic integration. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I thought that was a fair question. And USTR Michael Froman was very dismissive, and he said, well, the European thing didn't work out very well, did it? And I thought, I don't know. Is that it? That's your answer? It wasn't really great from your point of view, so we're not going to have anything at all, and we'll just go ahead with something that's completely one-sided in favor of investor and business interests. I think that's still a fair question. If this has been our history and this has been the one source of political and economic stability, we ought to take it seriously, and we ought to look for that kind of balance and political voice in whatever we do at the global level.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with you. And actually, you know, I had promised at the beginning of the program, given that this is the week for the climate march in New York City, that I would kind of interject, you know, a little bit of the lessons learned by neighbors and communities and at activists who are working on various fronts to protect communities from contaminating, economically destabilizing, and ecologically destabilizing industrial initiatives. Because, you know, we already have some examples from that world that I'm aware of how that this could work to our detriment, and I'll just name two of them very quickly. One is the role of FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It sounds like a publicly accountable body. Its job is to license and approve the construction of gas pipelines to bring the drilled gas to end users and to ports where that can be exported. So FERC is the overseeing agency, and because it's called federal and commission, everybody naturally assumes that, you know, there's some accountability to to the public. In fact, that's not the case, and it's really a rubber stamp agency for the gas and oil industry. They're not required to disclose. They're not required to look at health or environmental impacts. They basically treat a lot of the information as proprietary. They let the public know in small segments, you know, here's the next phase where something will be constructed, without, you know, kind of seeing the full picture of the entire pipeline and where it's going, which would allow a group of communities to kind of organize across many states, perhaps. So it always takes people by surprise, and I've had people on the program talking about these pipelines, where they go, what they do, and, you know, someone said to me, this isn't democracy. There's no public oversight here. So that's one example. And this, you know, there could be, you know, with these treaties coming in, there could be, you know, we think it's American, we're defending American democracy, we're defending American freedom and independence, and actually we're opening the door to global powers, foreign nationals, all kinds of things coming in here and really holding sway over us. Another example is up in Canada. Some of the lands over which, where they're trying to build these horrible, highly polluting and climate change accelerating tar sands projects are Native American land. And as such, the Native American communities have been able to kind of stall their efforts because it's on their land and they have a say, and they are actually exempted from Canadian national law, and they can't be overruled by Canada because of these treaties that give them those land rights. However, with these new agreements, what they're finding actually even without the agreements is that the companies are now saying, you stop our project, we're going to sue you till the end of time for the financial loss that generates, that, you know, you're stopping it generates. And so they're going to hold these, you know, Native American territories and the people who govern them, accountable for a property, you know, an income loss, a profit loss. It's kind of like, it's like if I was just crossing through a right-of-way going across the street and you had to stop at a stop sign because I happened to be crossing as a pedestrian, and as a result your truck was delayed and then hit, you know, traffic on the highway and didn't get to a place on time and it created some kind of financial loss for you, you could say, you know, they could say you as a pedestrian got in my way through using your right of way, and, you know, right, that cost me money. So it's kind of like the minute these kinds of laws pass, the clock is ticking on all the ways that they, you know, are either profiting or not. And that suddenly becomes accountable not to their business, but to the general public. You know, it's right, pretty, it's kind of, it's hard to imagine that would ever happen. I think people listening to the show might think, oh, that could never happen. But, you know, FERC is already on the books. Right. A lot of this is happening. So, your thoughts?
Exactly. Well said. And I think this becomes a pattern then. Are we shocked, or will we let this happen again? Do we acknowledge that this is improperly balanced interest, you know, between public and private, or are we going to let it happen again? I think the significance of the next trade agreements are that you have 40% of the global economy on Pacific, 40% of the global economy on the Atlantic, and then the services agreement is going to bottle up a lot of activity that's not involved in physical goods. And these will set global norms. And then the question is, are you shocked or not? Wait a minute, this becomes our moral and social values. We've agreed to this. Another part about this, now looking forward, I mean, everything you said about where we're drifting to is exactly right. Looking forward, if we had FERC and we decided that was poor public policy, we could go to the Parliament in Canada, or we could go to the Congress in the United States and say, you know, let's fix this, right? And we fix Social Security every year, and we fix taxes every year, and we fix things all the time. This is our political process. And then, you know, if we win the election, we get to appoint these judges. And if you win the election, you get to appoint your judges. With the trade agreement, there's not going to be any ongoing maintenance activity, right? You're done. This is it. This is the global standard, the norm. And they talk about harmonization. There will be chances to add more, right? But taking away what you've done will be very extraordinarily difficult. So we're talking about generations. And the other thing, you know, you brought up examples about the environment. President Obama said inequality is the defining challenge of our time, assuming we have time, right? But we don't have time if we don't solve the environmental problem. So what the challenges we face coming up are going to be spectacularly more expensive to oil companies than the things you're talking about, you know, permitting liquid natural gas port exports or whatever. The risks to the oil industry are astronomical going forward in the fight, you know, for our survival as a planet, for our ecosystem. The stakes are going to go up a lot. And the terms of engagement are going to decide whose interests prevail. So I still have plenty of shock potential. I'm still shocked. I'm still horrified. I'm still I think this is really shameless, and that the global norms that are, you know, potentially going to be reflected in the trade agreement are not mine. And you know, this is kind of me as a scientist again. It won't work. This will be a testable hypothesis. We're going to test the hypothesis, and the results are going to be very, very clear. You know, which we were talking about before, 20 years of lived experience with NAFTA, the rational conversation was easy. That was easy to have. The political conversation, the moral social values conversation, the political influence and power conversation, that's still a tough one. And the stakes are going to get bigger.
So basically, to summarize, because we're kind of coming down to the, you know, several last minutes of the program, and I also want to leave our listeners with some places they can go to kind of keep tabs on all of this. But to summarize, you know, James Hansen called the tar sands, which we were mentioning earlier. He said if this goes forward, it's game over. For the environment, and that's why we're having the Climate March here in New York this weekend. Please go, listeners, to 350.org or any other local environmental group, in fact, or national environmental group, Sierra Club, whatever your preference is. They're all coming in their contingents, and you'll be welcome to join and participate at any entree point. You know, New Yorkers Against Fracking has a contingent. Every environmental group is going because this is the unifying overarching issue. I would say that based on what we're talking about, this is game over for the environment on the economic and political level. In other words, our handle on being able to govern any of these fossil fuel companies or other forces that are playing into accelerating climate change is going to be completely crippled. If this proceeds as you have described. So I also want to urge our listeners to keep tabs on this issue at PDA America, which is spelled PDAMERICA.org. They are, you know, looking at this issue. You can also go to stopfasttrack.com. It's another place that you can go so that you're ready and prepared when things activate, as Stan Sorcher has described. You know, you're knowing that it's happening. You can also, you're welcome to follow my Facebook page at my personal name or Connecting the Dots for Health. Stan is reporting on this issue on the Huffington Post. You can go to Huffington, follow him there, get his updates. He'll be reporting on this as things progress. So I just want to, you know, kind of make sure that if you've heard this, if you've gotten it, you know, these are ways that you can stay informed in order to stay involved. And let your friends know, too, this is really important. And please do come on the Climate March if that's convenient for you. Thank you so much, Stan. It's been great having you back.
Good talking to you. I'm going to Canada for one of the Canadian border for our climate issue, and then we're having another march in Seattle. You have to show up.
Thank you. You're absolutely right. This is the time to show up. Exactly. Thanks, Stan. And please do, you know, keep in touch as things progress so that we can let the listeners know as well. And thank you for the terrific work and analysis. I think you've made what sounded like too complicated an issue I couldn't follow into something that's very real and direct and compelling. So, you know, thank you for your terrific work on this. And we'll have you back to the show again. And thank you, listeners, you know, for tuning in with us every week on Connect the Dots. Hope you've enjoyed the show, even though this is, you know, scary stuff that we all have to face up to together, and put our collective power, our focus, our intention, our actions, our, you know, our bodies, where they need to be, to intervene while we can. So hope to see you this Sunday. Hope you'll be there, and please do tune back in next week at Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. We're here every week on Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Thank you, and have a great week.